until that last day in the court when it's all finalized and this is your adopted son, wham, you're always kind of nervous. So it was extremely emotional for me, especially during the court proceedings. They ask you to say and spell your own name for the record. I was crying. I couldn't get it out.
It's the Foster to Forever podcast. Happy stories of non-traditional families born through foster to adopt. I'm your host, Rachel Fulginetti. Hello and welcome to the show. We are here today with Hope and Jesse Mackey. This is a full circle moment for me, because these were two of the first people that I spoke to when I decided that I wanted to go on this journey of foster to adopt. I wasn't even 100%. My husband and I were like, we're scared out of our minds. We're considering this. And we had a friend, I have a friend through VoiceOver, who told me, hey, I know somebody who did this successfully twice. Would you want to talk to them? And I was like, yeah. So I remember calling, and I remember Hope saying, like, okay, what you're going to do is you're going to come over, we're going to have some dinner, and we have to have some wine, because whenever you talk about the county and fostering, like, you got to have a little wine, and, you know, we'll tell you everything that we know. And I was like, okay. So we went over, and again, like, just feeling so vulnerable and so weird about it. And you guys were so kind and so nice. And your kids were like, I've never seen such beautiful children in my life.
They are beautiful.
So adorable. Yeah, it really just, that was what made us be like, okay, I think we can do this. Like, these people are like us, like, they're artists like us, and they're, you know, they figured it out, and we can do this. So my sincerest thank you, now that I've just finalized on the adoption of our son. So now we have two through Foster to Adopt. And anyway, I'm just so happy to talk to you today.
We've mentored dozens of families through in different aspects, just having people over for dinner like you and telling them, and then they go off. And sometimes we mentor all the way through to, like, you know, we are there in the courtroom. So it was so amazing to find out. I think you had texted me halfway through with some questions and we chatted. So I didn't know. So to come back and find out the rest of your story has been really special for me.
I know. Thank you. And it's been 7 years, because my daughter just turned 7, and we got her when she was 3.5 weeks old. So that's crazy. Like, just that aspect of it. First, I want to hear just about how you guys came to this journey, foster to adopt. And I kind of know your story, first of all, because you shared it with me 7 years ago, but also you did this beautiful movie, which we'll talk about in a little while. But just so that the listeners know what your story is, how did you come to it? Is it something that you always thought you were going to do? Was it a shock? Tell me.
So we got married a little later in life. So, but we knew right away we wanted to have kids. I thought it was done because of my age, but Jesse was like, nope, we're going to be parents. So we pretty much started trying right away. And within a month or two of getting married, we went to a fertility doctor and found out that this wasn't the path for us. One of my best friends was years ago a DCFS social worker, and said, you should look into this. Mm. So that kind of started the whole journey for us. And we went to classes, and we were like, this is what we want to do. We also are of limited means. And we knew we didn't want to spend everything we had on an adoption and then not have everything to raise our kid or give our child whatever it needed. So that's sort of what started this path. And then we started the licensing process. And within 6 months, we were placed with a 6-month-old boy named Landon, who, fortunately and unfortunately, because, you know, foster adopting is all about reunification. 9 months later, 9 months later, he went back to his mom. We were there the whole process, you know, weekly visits, overnight visits, helping her become a better parent. And he thankfully went back to, you know, a home where he could thrive. And then within a week and a half, we were placed with Lewis. And Lewis was supposed to be a state now, surveyor.
let me stop you right there.
Do, because I talk a lot.
I just want to stop and ask you about, it's great. I just want to ask, there's so many interesting things I want to just pick up on.
Sure.
Before we move on. So you guys always knew that you wanted kids. Yes. Always yep. knew that you were comfortable with adopting, or was that a hurdle that you had to?
Always had the thought in my heart of wanting to have biological children, but then also adopt on top of that. And so when the biological thing turned out to not, you know, work for us, it was just an immediate pivot. Like, okay, well, what are you doing now? And she went along with it. So
we had conversations. Right. We had conversations when we were dating about like, hey, you know how old I am, right? You know, and so he's like, oh, I don't care. We'll adopt. So we sort of knew going into it was, I mean, it was devastating. It's always devastating. It was devastating, but we were able to pivot.
Right. Gotcha. And do you mind, and if you don't want to say this, I totally get it, but do you mind telling us how old you were? Just because a lot of people have this barrier about age, and I'm an older parent too, and they'll say to me, I'm too old to do this now. I can't do it. It's too late. And I'm like, no, it's not. So you could just give me a ballpark or whatever, just so that listeners know.
She was in my late 30s. She was in her early 40s.
I think I said just turned 41 when we got married.
Okay. Gotcha. Yeah. That I was in my, I think I was, by the time we got Izzy, I think I was 44. Mm-hmm. So I was late. And when we got Dominic, I was 49 by that point. So I am like really old to have like an almost 2-year-old. Yes. But like, I always say like, you know what? It keeps me young. It is exhausting, but you know what? Like, life is exhausting. Pick your poison. Anyway, getting back to you guys. So you went directly through the county. Is that correct? So there's two different ways that you can go about fostering to adopt. You can use a foster family agency, and that's what I did, or you can go directly through the county. Can you speak to that experience?
Basically, we didn't know any better. That's why we did what we did, was we just went straight. Okay. We didn't know about FFAs. We didn't know about the support that you can get through an FFA. We just were like, okay, I guess this is how you do it. And we went straight into the county.
So we have since learned, since we've been on this, you know, this path for a long time, and since we've helped so many people. And one of our social worker who placed us with my son, Lewis, has become a really good friend and like an auntie in our house. So she has helped us with questions over the years. Mm-hmm. But going straight through DCFS just means that, you know, a DCFS social worker is connecting you. You take your classes and you go through that way. The FFAs, DCFS also uses straight people like us who are working with them. And then, you know, there's not enough foster families. So they also then use the FFAs.
Right.
And they funnel to, you know, choices to the FFAs, which is why when you work with an FFA, then you get the call. There's really no rhyme or reason for it. So there was a period a few years ago where Hillary had told us, don't send anybody else to DCFS. We're overwhelmed. Send them to the FFAs because they're helping more. And now, and then recently she's just said, oh, no. It's better to go straight through DCFS. There's a lot of pros and cons, which is probably, you know, in an entire other podcast. It worked for us because we also then have access to Ties for Families, which is an amazing resource and a wraparound service through UCLA that has helped us from infancy, from our first foster son, all the way through therapy we get now for both my kids for different issues that have come up.
And group therapy for us. We went to group infant group therapies where we met other parents that were in the same boat with their kids talking about it. Was the meetings were for the children's issues, but ultimately it ended up being a source of information for us just being in a room with other foster adoptive parents.
So that's actually
sounds great. I've actually heard of UCLA Ties.
That's why I actually now people call me and are waffling. I sort of steer them to DCFS because the extra support from Ties has been pretty much why we went back in. Why we when our first foster son went back and we were devastated, they just took us in a big hug, and that's why we finalized. You know, now we have two amazing children.
So do they act at like a foster family agency in that regard? Like, are they there for you? They don't offer you the placement.
No.
That comes straight through the county.
They're basically just there for wraparound services later if things come up.
Mental health services.
I see. Okay.
Yeah.
Like regional center.
Sort of kind a regional of. Center, but like 1,000 times better. Like just,
right. on,
you know, just more accessibility. They're funded. So, you know, it's been an amazing resource for us. So
I've heard great things. And it's funny, I actually tried to get in there when I heard about them this past year and I couldn't get in. Getting back to Landon.
Mm-hmm.
So you had him for 9 months, did you say? 8 months, 9 months?
9 months.
From when he was about 15 months old till he, no, was it?
He was
no, I'm
nine
sorry, six and a half
old.
Months to 15
six
months.
Meal, yeah.
Did it look like reunification was kind of going to happen? So you were somewhat prepared as much as you could be?
Probably about halfway through, we started realizing mm-hmm. that this was not going to be a permanent situation. It was hard for us. Mm-hmm. It was hard for us to wrap our mind around that because, you know, we didn't, you know, we were DCFS, well, anyone who gives you a call, they just want to place the child.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a lot of talk of you're a fast tracked or this one looks really good because they just want the child to be placed with a family.
Uh-huh.
So we learned that the hard, you know, like every other family does. And
yes.
So we thought in the beginning, this was looked like it was going to be immediately permanent situation. And it was, we were aware that it didn't look like that very soon. And then it got worse. So about halfway through, it was like, oh no, this is just us getting him ready to go back to mom.
Uh-huh. I can't even imagine what that would be like because you're just, especially with an infant, I mean, with any child, but you're there every step of the way, every second. And then to just have them removed, I can't imagine that pain.
No, we both managed, at least I think, we were able to sort of, at least I guess I should speak for myself, I was able to sort of take solace afterwards in the fact that we were able to give him a fresh start and to allow his mother the time to become a better parent. And we watched it all happen. I mean, she did every single thing they asked her to do. She wasn't, you know, a horrible person. She just was in a bad situation. And she jumped through everything because she wanted her son back. And then she ultimately earned that.
Yep.
But we were able to give him sort of a restart and her at the same time. So that the end was very abrupt. The end was like, you know, okay, you have it's done now. It's over. You have an hour. Bring him to this place with all his stuff, and you're done.
That was pretty horrible. They had moved up the court date without telling us because I'm loud, and so I had voiced concerns. So I think they were trying to get, you know, there's a lot of broken in the system.
Yeah,
but you know, the whole process taught us about. What, you know, we thought we were like foster to adopt. We're going to foster this child. And then, you know, Pollyanna going into it. And this taught us the importance of just, oh, this is about the kids. This isn't about me becoming a parent. This is about placing a child and us taking care of it and becoming a parent and just loving that baby or older child or whatever child in order to, for them to have a better life. And it doesn't, and we became less important in that placement. So we learned more about reunification and what it means and why. And then we became a better parent for our subsequent children that became permanent.
Exactly. I've talked about it a little bit in some of the interviews, but I'll just mention briefly in case listeners don't know that the primary goal of any foster case is reunification with birth family. Mm-hmm. And that really stays that way until the parental rights have been terminated. And it takes a long time to get to that. They don't terminate those rights easily, which is a change from how they used to do it. And rightfully so. So, you know, a lot has to happen for them to terminate those rights. And then the child becomes available for adoption. So I always try to tell people, you know, every foster to adopt case is really just a foster case until it's an adoption case.
Yeah.
So that's a really important thing. And what you're saying is exactly what I came to. It's like, how do we wrap our heads around this? How do we do this? The only way, I think, to be able to go into this and survive it emotionally is you do it for the child. It has to be not about you. It has to be about, you know what? We're going to be in service to this child and their life path and journey. And if that life path includes staying with us forever, then that's great. And that's what we hope for. But if it's not, that's great too. Like they have a life path. They have a journey that they're here to fulfill, right? And so I just think it's the biggest and most amazing gift that you could give anyone is to provide just safety and love for however long you're meant to be with that human, right? So you had to say goodbye to Landon. Were you able to stay in touch with him at all or not?
We didn't. You wanted to.
We originally, there was some desire to maybe, but it just, the way things ended was very awkward and uncomfortable, and it just didn't end up happening.
It was just devastating for me, and I was worried about my mental health, and her family was pretty toxic and had gotten involved, and I thought maybe it was dangerous, and if we got a new placement, I didn't, you know, it was really my decision. At one point she had said, you're going to be his godparents, and I just thought it didn't feel appropriate to me.
Her family didn't really care for us and felt like we were sort of
interlopers
who were imposing our view of child rearing on them somehow, and that we know what we're doing and who are you to tell her? Even though the social worker had been telling us to tell her, like make a list of all his things and tell her what you do, and we did all that, but it wasn't
right.
You know, family sort of frowned on that, and so it was just an uncomfortable situation. Uh-huh. And once he went back, we got our son Lewis a week and a half later. So we didn't have a lot of time to sort of grieve.
Wow.
And that was a little awkward, but it's just the way, the time worked out.
So Landon went back. It was devastating. We started getting phone calls from our social worker, Hillary. And the first one we got, I said no to, because I was still like, I had just put his clothes, like the clothes that we kept in the dryer. I was like, I cannot have another baby. I wound up giving them all away because eventually I couldn't do it. So we said no to the first baby, and she was like, okay, let me just take you off the list for a minute and we'll take a break. And then it was Easter Sunday. We went to like an event with a kids thing, and everybody was shocked that we were at a kids event. And then we decided to go to Bed Bath & Beyond. And on the way to Bed Bath & Beyond, we saw a bassinet on the street. Like, and I was like,
easement on the side of the road.
And I'm kind of a trash picker. So I said, well, that's still there.
But
so,
it was like a gleamingly unused bassinet that someone was just put out.
We pulled over when we came back and we were like, what? This is weird. I'm looking around like,
did someone move into an apartment and forget this was here? Yeah. Because it's too nice to be sitting
on it was totally right. Trash. So we put it in the back and I start sobbing. This is like 5 or 6 days after Lana went. So the next morning we call Hillary, like, we're ready. She's like, okay, that's really quick. And I said, how about that baby from last? No, that it doesn't work that way. So
right.
That Wednesday we got the call for Lewis, and we went and got him. It was like, we were like, oh my God.
But it was another one of those. I don't know if yours went like this, but this was, okay, there's a baby. He's in Long Beach at St. Mary's Hospital. You have an hour to decide whether or not you're going to do this.
I don't even think we had 40 an hour.
Minutes, whatever it was.
10 minutes, like whatever.
I don't know. So, and but I was at a voiceover at my agent's office, and she called me and said, this is happening. And I was like, let's do it. So I drove home, got her. We drove down to Long Beach, shoveled sandwiches in our face in the car, and then went upstairs to the labor and delivery ward and picked up our son.
And when we got home, we're getting home and I'm like, oh my God, I can't believe this happened. I pulled out all the paperwork. I found out he had been born an hour after we found the bassinet. So
get out of here.
No. Oh. So I was like, oh, and there.
Okay.
When you're talking about
full body chills.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Things are supposed to happen. That's what it was. We weren't supposed to have the other baby. We were supposed to have
the first. That's right. And I find that in every single story, there's this meant to be aspect. Even if there was loss previously, it's like when it's right, it's right. And the universe delivers, like the universe like shows you the signs. And so that was something I'm sure that you could hold on to through the whole process. Like, well, this had to have been right. Like
the irony was that because of his health issues for the first 9 months of his life, he wouldn't be put down. So he was never able to sleep in the bassinet.
He never slept in that got.
did you keep it anyway?
Yeah. So Rose slept in it
later, but not him. He was like, "Magic bassinet, I'll show you." And then just we couldn't. If you set him down, he would start screaming and vomit. So he was like, "Okay, well, I guess he's not."
So how long did it take to finalize? And did you have to have visits and all of that, or was it just you never had contact with the birth parents?
When Hillary called us, I was like, "Hey, this time can we just figure out a situation? I know it's reunification, but I just maybe that doesn't have the you know the parenting like the I just don't know if I can deal with a mom right now. So maybe it might be a more dangerous placement." But Lewis's mom had some mental illness and some drug stuff happening and walked out of the hospital with a C-section a day or two after he was born.
Yeah, a day or two, yeah.
She had said she wanted him to be a safe surrender, but because they didn't get down there to have her sign the papers because it was the hospital, then they had to go searching for her. They couldn't. So we were called ostensibly a safe surrender, which was not. And it took 22 months. And mess ups,
right?
Mess up after mess up after mess up. Publishing, searching for mom, searching for dad.
Yep.
Was ridiculous.
In the DCFS system, if things aren't done in the pre-stated amount of time, it gets continued.
Yeah.
It gets continued, it gets continued, it gets continued.
Yeah. Yes.
And, yeah.
We had to do publishing too. And again, for listeners who are like, what is publishing? So if they can't find the birth parents, and this was the situation with my daughter, they were homeless and they had no way to serve them papers. Mm-hmm. So you cannot terminate parental rights or do anything like that if you can't serve the people, because legally they have to be served. So there's this other process called publishing where they have to publish like an ad and it's some particular publication and it has to only be a certain amount of days. It's crazy. It can be no more than this, but no less than that. And the rules are insane.
In today's modern world of emails and websites, it feels very antiquated to have to publish something in a newspaper.
There was one time we were continued. They hadn't published by one day. They hadn't got, it was dumb. And then another time they had left out a word. The actual paper had left out a word, like an "and," where, like, what?
Yes.
So we just kept getting confused.
Yes.
So
yes.
It took 23 months.
And so
there was no disruption of that. I mean,
yes,
like, there was nobody popping up. He never went anywhere. We had him with us for the whole 22 months, and it was fairly seamless. I mean, except this was going on in the background.
And it still took that long. Yeah. To give context, Dominic, my son, was a safe surrender, and it still took 22 months.
Oh, God.
22 months? 21 or 22 Let's months. See. Yeah. Can you believe that? And he was an actual safe surrender. That's crazy.
We have another friend. I think it took like 13 or 14 months, and I thought that was crazy. I hadn't heard that there was one. Like, 22 is crazy.
It's the same thing.
Oh, yeah. He's almost two.
Nobody is attached to this child.
Yeah. It's almost harder in a weird way. I mean, not really, but it's weird. It makes me, I always tell people, so you've got to be somebody who is, or it behooves you to be somebody who's very, like, not relentless, but it's like that. Like, you have to be somebody who's just
dogged.
You've got to be able to, like,
determined, yeah.
Yes, dogged is a good word. And you got to notice all the little details and kind of provide oversight, but without being too pushy, because if you're too pushy, forget it, then they're going to hate you and then they won't do anything for you, because you know what I mean? So you have to really walk that fine line of like being helpful and being polite, but, you know, not overstepping, and like it's a dance.
Also being unafraid to ask for what you need or advocate for the child's needs.
Yes. But you are also seen as the interloper who's trying to take the child away from their rightful family. That is your role. All the way.
Yes.
That's what we came up against every time, from social workers, from the court, from parents. Like, you're seen as the person trying to take the kid away. You know, it's being a foster parent, being a decent foster parent is challenging, because I know we get a bad rap in some ways, but it's really like you really have to be strength. You have to have strength in your convictions.
Yeah, 100%. Okay. So you finalize with Lewis. Mm-hmm. Talk about that day. What was your adoption day like?
It was so emotional because you're always sort of on your, tiptoes until the moment when the judge finally slams down the gavel and it's all official.
That's right.
And done. You're always sort of worried about somebody popping up out of nowhere going, I'm a long lost uncle. I want this baby.
Yeah.
Until that last day in the court when it's all finalized and this is your adopted son, wham, you're always kind of nervous. So it was extremely emotional for me, especially during the court proceedings. They ask you to say and spell your own name for the record. I was crying. I couldn't get it out. The lawyer had to say my name and spell it for me because I was like, so it was an extremely emotional day. And it was wonderful. You feel all the love. You have all the aunties and uncles, like, 20, 30, 40 people crowded into this tiny little courtroom, all there to love you. And it's really, you feel the weight of that. And it's a pretty amazing day.
I do have to say, though, alternately, I actually wound up going to therapy for a little bit. I had a little depression right afterwards because I had a worry. Although the day itself was joyous, it wasn't, I was like, we didn't go right into like, yay, everything's okay. And I couldn't figure out why I couldn't. I still had just that nagging worry in the back of my head, and finally came to the realization through through a little course with some therapy that even though the judge slams the gavel, this is your child, you can breathe, you still are parenting. So everything is not Pollyanna. Everything's not all okay. Because my expectation, I think, in the back of my head was that everything, oh, yay, it's going to be final. And we're a family unit now. And there was a little bit of like, why don't I feel more relaxed about this? And ultimately, it's like, oh, wait, God, now this is permanent. This is my kid. I'm a parent. And forever and ever. Mm-hmm. Whereas before it was like, maybe that's your kid, maybe it's not. So for me, as joyous as the actual day was, and it's like, this is so crazy, I had sort of a crisis right afterwards, which, I had to work through.
Thank you. Thank you for sharing that, because I don't think a lot of people share that. And I think it's almost akin to postpartum depression, in a weird way. Yeah. You know what I mean? The other thing, I think what I'm really resonating with in what you're saying is it's so emotionally exhausting. Like the fostering journey is really, really emotionally exhausting. And then, okay, you adopt, but like, you really, it's not like all of a sudden you get to go on like a month long vacation in Tahiti and like relax and just, go off into the sunset. It's like you're saying, it's like, yeah, okay, now business as usual, you're still parenting and you still got a lot to hold. And it really took me that first time. It took us a good year, I would say, just to, like you're saying, to be able to really breathe. To be able to just let go of some of that stress. And it's almost like I had PTSD, like from going to the courthouse all the time and like all of that. And there was a spontaneous healing I felt on adoption day at the courthouse with all of our friends gathered. And it was so different from all the other times we had been at court. And I did feel like there was like a spontaneous healing that happened that day. But again, I will agree with you. We felt that exhaustion. We started right away. In fact, we were having a party for the adoption celebration so that my family from New York could come because they couldn't make it to the court because it happened so fast. It was all of a sudden, it was like, okay, your court date's in a week. We had been waiting for months and months and months. So we ended up having a party like a month later. And as I'm driving to go pick up my mom and my sister at the airport, I get a phone call. There's a baby girl who needs a home. And I know you guys just finalized and I know, but I just wanted to call and her name was Angel. And I never forget. I always think about Angel and I couldn't, like you were saying, like, I just couldn't do it. I couldn't do it. We weren't ready. I just was so exhausted. And I was like, there's just no way I can start this process again. So we said no to that placement, but I still think about Angel and hope that she's doing good and that she found a forever family. I really do.
To jump on that, about to talk about Lewis's finalization, once he finalized, we decided to go right back in right away. And because we needed to do a new home study because Lewis was now, a part of our family. We had to do another study to get another placement, but we were still on the emergency list because we had an empty bed because we were still licensed. And we, during that process, in 2.5 weeks after, once we went on the emergency list, we got 42 phone calls.
What? 42?
It was the emergency list. And I think about those kids all the time. Just like you said about Angel, I think about we still remember, like, there were the twins. One was in the hospital.
Yeah.
There was the 14-year-old.
The problem with being on the emergency list is they see that you have an open bed, an open foster bed in your house. And that's all. They don't read farther to see, we're looking for an infant, do we want a girl, blah, 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 whatever.
Right.
They see open bed and they call you immediately because they have so many kids that need a place to stay.
Right.
And so we got calls about teenagers. We had calls about 8-year-olds. We got calls about a set of twins, one of which was in the hospital. Wow. It was all these things that were beyond our scope of ability. And so we had to keep saying no. And it was just heartbreaking.
Devastating.
And then we got to...
The 2.5 weeks I remember I was at Sandy's. They usually called the home line and they had called my cell phone this time. And I was in this woman's pantry and I get this phone call and I hung up and I had said no. And I called Jesse and I was like, that's it. We got to get off this emergency list. I'm hysterical. And he's like, okay, tomorrow morning we'll call and get off the emergency list. And
it was like a Sunday, I think.
No.
Saturday or Sunday. It was an odd day because we had to wait till like the next business day to call. And I was like, let's just wait till Monday. We'll call.
Okay.
Say no.
The next morning, the next morning, we got the call for Rose.
That's before you took yourself off.
The last call we received before.
How did you know that was the call? Like, how did you know?
The last call was
She just checked the boxes of what?
No.
Like,
some of the boxes. And then, so we were like, and then I had, they, she was in the hospital for 4 weeks before we got her. So we didn't meet her until 3 weeks, but she was sick. She was going through withdrawals. Mm-hmm. And during that time, the social worker who had called us was like doing other things. And I had to track her down. I had to call our social worker to find our name in the system to see if we were connected with this baby. I tracked, like Rose was meant to be ours. I tracked her down. So we wound up going to see her in the hospital.
We were allowed to visit her in the hospital before we 100% committed.
Yeah. We found out uncle had been there. On paper, we should have never said yes because it was way too iffy. We walked in and I saw her in that bassinet and I thought there was not a doubt. I'm like, that's our baby. I had no doubt. Another meant to be story. So we had this little, we were placed with her. We had this whole thing like, what should her name be? And we had this argument about, I wanted Lily Rose. And he's like, that's two names. It should just be, so we decided to just name her Rose. But I kept saying, it should have been Lily Rose. It should have been Lily Rose. And then when we finalized, we wound up getting in touch with her grandparents. We keep in touch. I send pictures.
Her maternal grandparents.
The reason that they
when
we first emailed her, she said, I'm so glad to find out that she's being taken care of. The only reason we didn't take care of her was because I was taking care of my mother at the time, who has since passed, and her name was Rose.
Wow.
So she was named the right,
and that was the name that you guys picked out. Rose,
grandmother's name,
was my
insane.
Yeah. So anytime I'm like, it should have been Lily Rose, he's like, it should have been Rose. Yeah.
Wow. That's incredible. That's the story that I have is a very similar story where Izzy was, she was in the hospital, 3.5 weeks old. She had had open heart surgery. She was dealing with a lot of different stuff. So we were finally like, okay, we're going to go pick up this baby. And they're giving us all the information, UCLA, da, 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 da. And then I said, I forgot to ask, does she come with a name? And the social worker was like, let me see. Let me look. Her name is Isabella Rose. And I just screamed. My husband and I, it was on speakerphone, screamed because I had been pregnant back in 2012. And if it was a girl, the top name for us was Isabella Rose. And I am not kidding. I have a journal entry Isabella Rose was our top name, and this child was named Isabella Rose. So like,
crazy. That's so specific.
I know, but that's this is what I'm talking about.
Yeah, it's weird.
It's so crazy, but there's these things happen. So I knew, I was just like, okay, we're good. Yep. This is our kid. Like, there's no way this isn't our child. Like, yep. That's just, so anyway. And then my son was born on my husband's birthday, which was our sign that was our son. They were like, yeah, he was born 2 days ago. And I was like, wait a minute, on the 10th? And they were like, yeah. And I was like, dude, that's your birthday. Yeah. So anyway, meant to be. I love it. So you went through the process, and how long did you foster with Rose?
She was about 17 months. Her mom, her bio mom was in the picture. She had a history with DCFS. So they TPR, that's termination.
All right. Yep.
But they terminated parental rights much sooner because they could find her. They knew who she was. Right. And she had actually said that bio dad was dead. So that made everything a little smoother on our end.
Right.
We have since found out that probably was not bio dad, but it does not matter.
Her mom was a very active addict at the time. And a lot of what she may have told them, you know, may or may not have been true. It's hard to sort of suss out what was true or not.
She would show up and like, she would show up to the DCFS office and then just walk out. But we never wound up having any visits with her at all, even though she was in the picture.
Gotcha.
But because they knew where to find her, it made things easier to notice her and to keep the process moving. It made it a little bit quicker because they were able to find her and actually kind of speak to her. And also it made it easier to rule out any bio family that could take her.
Right. Yeah. I want to backtrack just a little bit because you've mentioned it about the drug piece, because a lot of people, when they're coming to me and asking about fostering to adopt, they're really nervous about, and understandably so, about the exposure piece, right? Like that. But all these children are, you know, like, I don't want a child who's been exposed to drugs. And I remember in our classes that we took when we were getting certified, they were very upfront with us. They were like, look, if you're waiting for a child who's never been exposed to anything, you're going to be waiting a really long time, because that's just not probably going to be the case. So, you know, whatever. So you gotta choose. And then as we became educated, we discovered and found out that, oddly enough, the drugs that seem like they're the hardest drugs and like the worst drugs, oftentimes those drugs, someone can recover from completely. Yeah. And it's other ones,
alcohol, that
ironically are like the legal ones, right? Like alcohol and nicotine, oddly enough, that are like the most devastating, long term. So I just was wondering if you could speak to that and your feelings about that and anything like that.
Because we, you know, we've been fostering for so many years now, mentoring for so many years now, excuse me. And this is exactly what we would explain, that really fetal alcohol syndrome is probably the hardest to
come back
from. I mean, it's a weird way of talking about it, but there's never not an issue. Both of my children are on, well, one is on meds. The other one, we're talking about meds. There's ADHD. That we have all the letters in our family. There's many, many letters. You know, Lewis has anxiety. And this is what we talk about. We have dozens of friends who have their own kids who birthed them out of themselves. Almost every kid right now has something. There's autism spectrum, there's ADHD, there's ADD. If you're a parent, you're going to be dealing with something. I would rather us because we were looking for it. We had all the early intervention. Our kids are thriving now. It's challenging. I never want to be Pollyanna and say, oh no, we're fine. It's effing hard. Parenting is hard. And then parenting from a foster adopt situation is another level of hard.
Yep.
But
to give a like very, you know, specific description, our daughter was born addicted to heroin. Like, she had withdrawals at birth. That's why she spent a month in the NICU. When we were visiting her, I would watch nurses squirt morphine into her mouth because they had to step her down from the heroin until she was totally free and clear. And that's when we were able to take her home, was after she had been stepped down. And she's now thriving and whip smart and sassy in the whole nine yards.
Very sassy.
She has issues, but all kids have issues. It's never like an open, open issue.
Yeah. The thing is we have wraparound services. We have so much more we can avail ourselves. We have a friend who adopted straight through open adoption, private open adoption, and she's having very similar issues, but doesn't have access to some of the help that we have. If you're in it, you're in it. So this is what I say to people. It's like, if you're parenting, that's it. You just have to do it, and you got to grit your teeth, and whatever comes up, you're going to deal with. And yes, there could be issues or there could not.
Much every group or individual we've ever spoken to, the main sort of takeaway, I think, is that if you're going to do this, you and your partner, or if it's just you by yourself or whatever it is, has to be very frank and specific about what you can handle in your family situation. And if that's not a lot of drug exposure, if it's no history of violence, if it's, how much family's involved before I say yes, whatever that thing is, you have to know what you can handle and be willing to say no if you know that's something you can't handle.
Yeah, you have to be the best parent.
Which is so hard because you don't want to say no to a child that needs a home. But at the same time, if you take a child that is beyond your means, then you're not doing either of you a service.
Right.
Yeah, I remember you telling us that. And I was so grateful for that piece. And I think a lot of people don't know that. I had a friend who was trying to do this in, I think it was Georgia or something, some other state. And they were telling her, she was working just directly with the county, and they were telling her, like, no, you have to say yes to everything. Like, you have to just, and she called me and was like, is this true? And I was like, no, like, absolutely not. I mean, I don't know how Georgia works their system, but like, no, you have to, as you said, like, you got to know what you're signing up for. And even when you think you know what you're signing up for, you still don't totally know what you're signing up for, because things can emerge, right? Different things will emerge over time.
In a lot of cases, social workers need to place that kid, so they'll try to sell you a little bit or soft pedal things that may be bigger issues for you, and because they need to place that baby. So it's like, and you have to be willing to dig as much as you can. But on the other side of that coin, as much as you may have educated yourself and as much as you know what you can and can't handle, a lot of times they don't have a lot of information when they're trying to place a baby. So at some point you just have to say, okay, we're doing this.
Right.
Yes, please. And go from there and then deal with what happens. Because if you hem and haw, you could spend your whole life not ever taking a placement. But it's a kind of a fine balance between knowing all the information, honoring yourself and what you can handle, and also having that gut feeling of, okay, we can try it. Well, let's try this. This sounds like a good situation.
You got to jump in at some point. Jump in.
That's right. Yeah. I love that. I said no 5 times before I said yes to Izzy. And the way that it works, at least with our agency, is that you don't even get an hour. You designate one person. If you're in a partnership, you designate one person to be the phone call taker. And that was me. They call you and you say yes or no. You can't even check with your partner because you need to already be on the same page as your partner, because they don't have time. They need to find this child a bed. So I felt so much pressure of being that person. Like, oh God, like what? This is so much pressure. And I went to a healer before this happened, trying to work through some of my fertility stuff and just have a fresh, clean slate so that I could do this. And I shared with her, this is the thing I'm the most nervous about, is getting this phone call. And I want to pick the right child. I want to pick the child that's going to be in our forever family forever. Like, I don't want to have to go through this if possible. I know there's a kid out there that's supposed to be in our family. And she said, okay, when you get the call, put your hand over your heart and just close your eyes and just feel. If it's a yes, say yes. If it's not a yes, don't say yes. So literally 5 times I got a phone call. I put my hand over my heart. I closed my eyes and I was like, oh, I'm just not getting a yes. It's not a yes.
No.
So I said no all of those times. And then with my daughter, same thing. I was going to a voiceover audition. I pull over on the side of the street. I take this phone call, put my hand over my heart, close my eyes. There's a baby girl, you know, start giving me the details. And I'm like, I think it's a yes. I think it's a yes. Like, can I call my husband? Please let me call my husband. Just let me call him. And the social worker was like, okay, you have like 3 minutes. Call him. If you don't get him, you got to just call me back. I call him. He's at work. Usually he would never pick up during work. He happened to be right there. He picked up. I start telling him, okay, there's a baby girl. And he goes, yes, it's a yes. Like right away. And I was like, it is, right? It's a yes. Yes. So that is how we handled it. But it is. It's a lot of, you kind of have to, and you told us this, like get as much information as you can, but they might not know a whole lot of information and they might spin the information a little bit. So yeah, you got to go with instinct, I think, at the end of the day.
You have to be willing to say no, but also you have to be willing to say yes if the right thing comes along.
Yep. Yep. Awesome. So now you guys are a united family of 4. Do you ever think about doing this again?
It's so funny. Somebody just asked us recently. No. I live in fear that we're going to get a phone call from a bio parent because, you know, you're attached to those kids. So you have to be the best parent you can be. And I think we're the best parents we can be to our children right now that would not involve another child. But that being said, mm-hmm. we have this fantasy and we have a tiny little house. Each kid has their own small room. There's no room for anybody else, mm-hmm. but the fantasy is once they go off to college or continuing education, whatever, that maybe we do respite care or have a teenager straight foster. So there's a fantasy, you know, who knows in 10 or 15 years if that will be something we could do, but that's the theory. So the reason why we do mentoring and we did the movie and stuff is because we still want to keep, we want to give back. But there's no way, well, I can't give back anymore by being a parent to another child. So that's sort of our justification.
These two keep us plenty busy right now.
Right.
And the idea of bringing another child into that is not appealing at the moment. But yeah, we would like to maybe foster, you know, when these two have gone off to college or what have you. But also keep doing what we've been doing throughout, you know, because this is an easy way for us to give back is just sharing our experience.
Yeah, absolutely. It's such a gift. Tell me about the movie. How did you make the movie? Tell the listeners about the movie, where they can see the movie and what the movie is.
So the movie came about because of it was when the ridiculousness of the whole thing with Lewis and with Landon's placement and realizing that this was so difficult and that people, there's such a need for foster families and people need to see the reality. So we decided, we met who has now become a friend of ours, Sarah Prickrell, who is an amazing filmmaker. She was sort of new to it at the time. She had done a couple commercials and she was dabbling. But we talked to her about, like, this is my idea, is to film the path all the way once we're placed with a new baby. This is before we got Rose. So it was right at the end of Lewis. So she came and filmed Lewis's adoption day to that end, because we thought, oh, we can use that and have that be a bridge. Lewis's adoption day video is incredible. It's on Vimeo. If you look up Lewis Mackey Adoption Day, I believe it is.
Something like, if you look up Sarah Prickrell on
Sarah Prickrell.
P-R-I-K-R-Y-L?
L-L.
L-L.
And Sarah is S-A-R-A-H. His Adoption Day video is there. And then, of course, she wound up doing one for her. She's amazing. And so this started it. And so we went from here and we were like, okay, we're going to start filming all the way through. But Sarah doesn't live with us. So there, and you get these phone calls.
Right.
Get random and like, oh, you know, a social worker's coming over now. Oh, you have to do this. So instead of her filming all the way through, I started using my cell phone. So we filmed like walking in to meet Rose, doing the whole thing. So we had this whole fantasy all the way through that this is how we were going to put together this documentary about our path to becoming a family of four. And then once, as it was going, you know, she's like, I can't be there always. So let's sort of towards the end, she's like, let's just start doing interviews because of course it's cell phone footage. Maybe I can intersperse some of your cell phone footage, but there, it's not really used. And I was doing it, you know, both ways, landscape, horizontal. I was not, I was a little dumb.
It was the idea of being able to film yourself with your cell phone all the time was fairly new at the time.
Yeah.
It wasn't as widespread as it is now.
Right.
9 years ago.
So none of us knew how to do it very well at that point.
So at the end, we had finalized on Rose, and she started just sitting down. She's like, let's just do some interviews and see, you know, because it'll take on a life of its own. And that's what it did. So she came back to us and she's like, you guys, I think you guys just talking about the story is our story. She's like, it's very powerful. We don't need 2 hours. She's like, it can be a short. So she created everything. So she basically did it. You know, we put together footage. She would send it to us. We would say yes, no. I mean, we're listed as producers, but Sarah was the mastermind.
She was the driving force.
And then we did a GoFundMe.
Right.
For, you know, the whole GoFundMe. And everybody, you know, thanks to Facebook, everyone knew. I'm one of those who uses Facebook as therapy. So everyone knew our story. So once we were like, we're trying to do this, and we GoFundMe. And so we got all this money in order to finish it. And we got this, you know, amazing music for it. And then we started putting in festivals, and we won a bunch of festivals too. So, and now I think there's a couple other factions that use it for training purposes.
Mm-hmm. Oh, great.
Yeah.
What is it called and where can people see it?
Oh, you know, I should put it in a better place, but it's called Family: A Love Story. And it is, if you want to see it now, I'm an actress also. So it's on my website, Hope Shapiro, HopeShapiro.com. And so just ignore all the rest of the acting stuff and go to the documentary tab. And it's there.
And if people did want to speak with you about, you know, to sort of not necessarily be mentored by you, but just have a conversation, are you open to that? Or can they reach you through your website? Or how do you feel about that?
I mean, that's what we do. So, yes, I think there's a way to send email there.
I think you
can probably reach you through your
same website.
Yeah.
If anybody has questions or.
Great. Last question. Do you have any advice for people who might be considering this path? What would you say to them?
Something that Hope always ends up saying to people is, if you think you can do it, you can do it. Like if you're already on this path and you're already looking into it and thinking, I don't know if I can do this, you can do it. However, it's also okay to realize you cannot and find another way to help, you know, but it's not the path. Is not always for everyone. And I know we live in a world where, you know, having children is, you know, looked at as such a must by a lot of people, but it's also okay to not do this. I mean, it's, if you are going through the whole process and you realize, I don't think I can do this, then you can honor that as well, but also know that you are strong enough to make it happen.
Just my biggest advice, just be honest with yourself. And if you're like, if you're going into this and you know, you're signing up for classes and you're doing it and you're like, I think I can do this. Then you can, then trust yourself. If you're signing up for class, you're doing all of it and you're all the way through, you're like, why am I doing this? Then don't do it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I appreciate you saying that because I had this thing where I really was so terrified to do this, but there was this little voice inside of me that was just like, we can do this. Like, we can do this. I know we can do this. And, but even though I was just terrified, so it was hard to like, I had to connect into that. And it's hard to know what the truth is, right? Sometimes it's hard to like, just decide for yourself, like, is the fear the truth? Or like, you know, anyway, Boy, it's been a pleasure talking to you guys, and I'm so happy for you and your family. And thank you so much for sharing your story with us.
Rachel, I'm so excited. I'm so excited. It's full circle. I'm so excited to hear your story and that you're doing this. It makes me feel like I had a
hand. I know.
It's really awesome. I love it. It's like my friend Jamie, she was on the board at Extraordinary Families, and she does a bunch of stuff at Extraordinary Families. She talks about it all the time because she started mentoring people through and helping people. And she always says, she's like, you're the mama bear. You started it, and now you gave birth to all of us who are going to now keep it all going, all of this amazingness going. So it's very special to be here and to talk to you.
Thank you, guys.
Thank you. Of course.
This has been the Foster to Forever podcast. Happy stories of non-traditional families born through foster to adopt. Produced by Aquarius Rising. Edited by Jason Cerubi at Split Rock Studios. Original music composed by Joe Fulginetti. For more information or to stay in touch, visit fromfostertoforever.com. That's from foster, the number two, forever.com. And stay connected with us on Instagram at Foster2ForeverPodcast. That's Foster, the number two, Forever Podcast. We'll see you next time.